Hello, I'm Harry Duran. I'm the host of Podcast Junkies and the founder of Fullcast. And today I'm here with historian, screenwriter, and bestselling author of one of my favorite books, Early Earth, Robin Maxwell. Hey, Robin.
Hello. Glad to be here with you.
So we're partnering together as co-hosts and co-producers on this new podcast, which we're calling An Alien in Hollywood. And it's going to be about the life and times of legendary filmmaker and godfather of Hollywood science fiction, Ron Shusett, who I've had now the privilege of meeting and interviewing in person. So what you're going to find out is that there's a lot more to Ron's life than meets the eye. And while there's nothing unusual about a biographical podcast about a brilliant filmmaker, I think the journey that got us here and the interviews that are going to kick off this series are going to be worth hearing about.
You know, unless you're a Hollywood behind-the-scenes aficionado, you've probably never heard the name Ron Shusett. Yet, he co-created, co-wrote, and produced three of the most influential, iconic, and mind-blowing science fiction blockbusters in film history, not only Alien, but Total Recall and Minority Report. His movies have grossed over $1.5 billion. They launched the careers of Sigourney Weaver and Ridley Scott and turned Arnold Schwarzenegger into the number one box office star in the world. He made author Philip K. Dick a household name. And with the release of Alien, Ron and his partner, Dan O'Bannon, spawned the whole Alien universe and the first movie franchise in history. With all that, a 50-year-long career, Ron is a consummate outsider. He's the most famous man in Hollywood you've never heard of. He is the alien in Hollywood. He's been my writing partner, mentor, and friend for over 30 years.
So, Robin, for the benefit of our listeners, how would you describe Ron?
Well, he's a showman, first and foremost, what they used to call an impresario, kind of a flamboyant nerd. He's got this mad, goofy laugh, which you'll hear in the interviews, and he's got the biggest, bushiest eyebrows west of the Mississippi. The thing about him, I guess, that sets him apart is that quite early in his career, he had the foresight to option not just one, but two Philip K. Dick science fiction short stories. One of them became the most expensive movie ever made up to that time. That was Total Recall. And the other became Steven Spielberg's and Tom Cruise's movie, Minority Report. But I guess Ron's real claim to fame is that he dreamed up, literally dreamed, one of the most memorable moments in cinema history, the alien chestburster scene.
Yeah, and having heard the story firsthand from Ron, I can definitely attest to what a fantastic tale it is.
That moment, I think, scared the crap out of every single person who ever saw the movie.
Oh, yeah.
I'd say most people consider it the best, most outrageous movie scare ever. In fact, the alien egg, which delivered probably the second biggest scare in the movie when John Hurt stuck his head down into it and the creature jumped out and attached itself to his face. That egg was actually admitted to the Smithsonian Institute for its place in history.
That's wild.
Isn't it? Nobody would ever describe Ron Shusett as modest or humble, as you will hear. But he's really unpretentious. He's been married to the same woman for 40 years. Linda is an executive producer for the Foundation of American Musicals. And together, their lives are dominated pretty much by a house full of dogs, cats, and ducks. They've never been A-list party regulars, and you will definitely not see Ron Shusett on a Hollywood's best dressed list. I've seen him wear two cardigans and two scarves at one time, and he doesn't go anywhere without his tweed flat cap. I've been listening to Ron tell his outrageous Hollywood stories for 35 years, and I've always thought that other people would want to hear them too. At first, I thought maybe it should be a book. Then I thought a magazine article. Then the internet happened, and I considered doing it as a blog. All this time, I had just finished up my historical science fiction trilogy called Early Earth that Ron had been part of since the beginning.
And that's a fantastic segue into how we actually met, because it was that first book that I was interested in, so much so that I actually followed up with you in a cold email asking you when volumes 2 and 3 were going to be available. And much to my surprise, you actually replied back to me.
Yeah. And I was really impressed with your email to me. You were asking intelligent questions, and you just seemed like somebody that I wanted to know. And it doesn't happen very often that I get into a back and forth with a fan of my writing. At that point, I'd had my head stuck in writing for 5 years trying to finish this trilogy. And so I was completely unaware of the podcast world that had just kind of exploded onto the media scene. And after a few really great conversations that we had on the phone, you introduced me to the world of podcasts. And suddenly I realized that this would be the perfect medium to tell Ron Shusett's story as a podcast. And so here we are today.
So fast forward several months and many, many conversations later, yeah. And we finally landed on this format, and we were able to actually get time scheduled with Ron, which was fascinating for me because he's busy and he's got a very interesting life that he's lived, as you'll hear. And I had the privilege of actually getting out to California to record these conversations. So they are conversations of the moment, and you'll hear plates jangling and dogs barking and I think the occasional leaf blower, but I think it was, rather than trying to record a pristine sounding NPR style show, I think what was actually more important was using the technology that we had on hand and the availability of Ron and Linda being gracious enough to help coordinate all of this to actually get these recorded. So while they may not be perfect in sound quality, I think they more than make up for it in terms of the content itself. So Robin, you want to talk a little bit about the format for these first couple of episodes?
Yeah, I think that what most people are interested in, at least to get a first taste of who this man is, would be the stories around the making of Alien. And we have 3 episodes. The first is the early days when Ron got together with his partner, Dan O'Bannon. And the second episode will be the pre-production and the beginning of production. And the third episode will take us through the end of production and into the screenings and the reception of the movie that really took the world by storm.
Yeah, as I think about those recording sessions, I remind myself of where I was when I first saw that movie and the impact it had on my life. And so it was a bit surreal to be sitting there with the actual creator, the co-creator of that movie. So I'm really honored to have had that experience. And I'm actually grateful for having met you and our ability to partner together to tell Ron's story.
Mm-hmm. That's been a pleasure. And I think everybody's going to get a kick out of some of the most insider Hollywood stories from the quintessential Hollywood outsider, the alien in Hollywood, Ron Shusett.
So let's get into it.
So Ron, we're just going to jump right into Alien.
Okay, sure.
Because that's what everybody wants to hear about.
Sure,
we won't
sure.
Wait.
Right.
So let's start at the beginning, the birth of the movie.
Okay.
Here's something you once said about your screenwriting partner on Alien, Dan O'Bannon. You said, "O'Bannon was living in a garret and starving like me. Neither of us had an agent." Would you talk about your circumstances when you guys met? Dan was apparently stuck with this idea for a science fiction horror movie.
Yeah, at the birth of Alien. Dan went to film school, USC, where, you know, Lucas and a lot of great filmmakers emerged from, and I didn't. I went to UCLA, and so I didn't know him, but I had heard about a little film he did that Roger Corman released called Dark Star. It was a low budget, and I saw his name. When I saw it, I said, and it said, you know, and then I read biography. He's done another thing. He did that as a thesis at film school. So I said, I got to start working with this guy because he did all the special effects for a song. And yet he's brilliant and inventive. So something I want to get done without spending a huge amount of money, I should be working with this guy, his screen brilliance and his special effects brilliance. So I sent him the Total Recall, having seen his short film from Roger Corman. And it was just came from a college project as a senior. I said, I got to start working with him because I need somebody to help this short story. It needs second and third act. There's just a first act in a short story. I need somebody brilliant but who's good at cheap special effects for big budget. And so I looked him up, and there's Garrett living. He graduated from USC, and he was living in an attic up there. And Linda and I were living in just one room apartment, just a living room and a bedroom.
Where was that, Ron? Where were you?
That was in Hollywood. My rent was about $35 a month, I think, living in Hollywood. And Dan was living down by USC. And I looked him up, being so impressed with this. I wanted him to help me. It had nothing to do with Alien. I didn't know about Alien. I wanted to get his help on developing the short story by Phil Dick into Total Recall. We later got it made for $1 zillion together, okay? So I went to him for that. I had no idea of anything about it. And he said, look, I love this short story. He knew all about science fiction stories. So he had read it. I sent him a short story. I said, I want to do this movie. He said, I love it. I want to do it with you. Yeah, I realize it's only got a first act. But he said, I have something for you that only has a first act. And I want to do that with you because if you have the brilliance to realize this Phil Dick story, and everybody's saying, oh, you can't make it, can't do it. I think you might be able to help me make my movie, and then I'll help you make your movie. And I said, okay, well, what is your movie? And he said, okay, I don't trust you because I don't know you. So you got to read it right here in front of me. I have one act. That's all I have. And I'm stuck, totally stuck for years. I can't get any help from any of my contemporaries. I get bad shit from them, you know. I don't know. I can't figure out what to do after the first act. I'm on page 29. And I've been stuck on page 29 for 2 years. Maybe you can break through for me. And then I'll help you break through how to make the Phil Dick short story in a full-length movie. I said, okay, well, where do I get your story? Well, I'm gonna give it to you to read while I'm here. You can't leave here. You can just read it. The first 29 pages. Tell me what you think. Tell me if you want to help me. So I read it, and I said, yeah, it's absolutely brilliant, Dan. He's okay, and Total Recall, the short story for Total Recall is brilliant. So I think we should start on mine because yours has to be done for a huge amount of money. Mine can be done for a modest budget, even though it's sci-fi. Alien, it could be done, as we know. It was done big budget, but it could be done real cheap in just a few rooms. So I said, that's agreeable. We'll work on yours first, and then you'll help me try and make Total Recall. He said, okay. So he said, okay, you've read it, you love it. I said, yeah. Can you have any idea how I can get past page 29? I'm stuck for 2 years on page 29. I said, well, the first 29 pages is amazing. He said, I know that, but I can't get past that. So he said, you guys any thoughts? I said, well, yeah, I might. I said, okay, well, then think about it. You can't take it with you. Go back and tell me if you think how we can get the second and third act of this movie. Because I'm totally given up on how to solve it, and all my contemporaries can't help me either. I go to a mall, film school. Nobody can figure it out. What to do from here? I said, okay, well, I think I can help you. And he said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, it's not going to take a minute. He was so broke, he said, well, can I move in? Because I'm losing my place here. I live on your couch. And Linda was supporting me. And I said, okay, she'll support both of us. That's all. She was working at the hospital as an assistant. They said, okay, it was two rooms. Dan and I had the living room. Linda and I had the bedroom, right? He moves on the couch. And we start trying to figure out how to get to act two and three for Alien. And we're working for months. We're just staring at each other. We're getting, I don't know, months or 2 months. We get nowhere. A month, 2 months. We can't solve it. And he says, well, I'm sure. I said, Dan, maybe I can't make the breakthrough. I'm sure you've made more progress in just getting close in these months or 6 weeks I've been with you. I'm sure you can do it, Ron. I'm sure you made more hope for me that I can finish this script than any guys I've been trying to work with in the last 2 years.
Had he already come up with any of the life cycle of the alien in the different phases?
No, none of that existed. It was just a setup. It was before the alien got on board.
Oh, okay.
It was outside, and before it got on board and then was came out of the ship, that was still, all he had was...
That was his first act.
Yeah, somehow an alien would get on board. Didn't have anything about it being in anybody's body, but he said, that's what I need. How can the alien get on board in a way that nobody's ever seen? So he was smart. He realized that's the secret to unwind it. But he said, if you can help me get that secret, how does the alien get on board in a way that's incredible? I said, well, let me think about it. So I'm going to try and help you. So about a month went by and nothing. We can't get like he and his contemporaries. I couldn't get past that. So I said, I'm exhausted. I'm going to go to sleep. Maybe tomorrow I'll make some progress. So, okay, in the middle of the night, and I know it's not a dream. I know it's when the brain works because it's in your dreamlike state, but your brain is thinking.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's when I came up with a solution that very night. I all of a sudden I get up about 3 a.m. because he's just in the living room. And Dan, I have it. I know how the alien gets on board. How? The alien impregnates one of the humans. What the hell are you talking about? I said, well, he puts a tube down his throat, plants a seed. It's growing in there. You can't see what's growing. He's got ink like an ox. We can't see. X-rays show nothing. And then he bursts out of his chest. Oh, my God. He looks at, that's it, Ron. That's it. Nobody's ever seen anything like that. Within 3 weeks of that, we had the whole story. That one idea, it just took 3 weeks. We got the story structure completed, but not the screenplay. Just the whole rest of the structure, okay? And I think it was another 2 months before we got the actual script on it. But we got that, and it worked. Everything worked. Just from that one idea, we realized we had the solution. But what is the odds that from that meeting in his garret would come Total Recall and Alien, both huge budgets, gigantic hits. We didn't even have an agent, an attorney, nothing. So now we have the complete script.
And then something interesting happened. This Alejandro Jodorowsky called, the director,
trying
to lure Dan to Paris to work on Dune.
Yeah, and he did. He went. He went to work on the script to Dune, the first version of Dune before it got made.
Except that with him, that collapsed. But out of that trip to Paris came another really important piece of the puzzle for Alien, because that's where Dan met
Giger, who was a surrealist painter, not a designer of movies in any way. But he got painted art. And Dan said, this guy should design our sets for Alien. He started working with us by doing little drawings. We didn't have any money to pay him. We said, maybe we can get the studio to hire you if we get it made. So he started working with us, reading our script and drawing little 8x10 colored drawings of it, which we inserted in the script. We finished it. But the studio saw it and hated it. Said, no, this is practically pornographic. It's so horrible. And I said, well, that's what a horror movie is. It's too horrible. 6 people will come to see it. Forget it. We're not going to hire this guy. This is disgusting. He doesn't have... Well, how do we know if he designs a set, what it'll look like on the screen? We need an experienced set designer, you know, the effect designer. And they wouldn't let us talk. They said, if you mention it again, we're firing you. So the only way we got Giger involved was when Ridley Scott came in. Part of an amazing moment in that, Linda took me to see a minister, a Presbyterian minister. I'm Jewish. When I was so discouraged because I thought... I can't get anything made. Alien was mine. Total Recall was, but I couldn't get a second and third act. So she said, I'm going to take you to this guy that I've known all my life, and wants to meet you. And we told him, I can't get anything done. I'm stuck. I'm hopelessly stuck. And you know, he said, it was weird. He said, okay, I'm going to tell you something right now. I have a reading from you. I have a sense for certain things. Everything is going to happen for you. Very soon, in a couple of weeks, the guy's spiritual. He says, well, what do I have to do? Nothing. You just go home and wait for the miracle. It's going to hit in about 2 weeks. It's going to hit, and you're going to have everything's going to change, and all the things you're trying to do are going to happen almost immediately. So naturally, I was so dumb, I believed. I said, oh, this is fantastic. You know, of course, he was a minister, so his job was making me feel better. And all of a sudden, in about, like you said, about 2 weeks, the phone rings. And it's Dan. He says, Ron, can I come stay in your couch? My project's falling apart. I ran out of all my money in pre-production. I have nowhere to go. I said, Dan, you're my miracle. He says, what? I said, I've been promised a miracle, and you're my miracle. What do you mean? I said, well, this minister told me. He said, Ron, this minister tells that to everybody. He says, this is a bunch of bullshit I've ever heard. Because Dan was very practical and hostile. You know, I'm glad you give me a place to leave, but I don't think I'm your miracle because this call is not going to be a miracle, which it was a miracle, you know.
Is that when Roger Corman came aboard?
Oh, yeah. We almost got it made with Roger Corman right after that, after we got the script completed. Okay, so Dan started living there, and we started working, and it took us months, but we finally, as I described, when I made that one breakthrough, we got the script, okay, in one piece. But we didn't go anywhere with it because it was so big and so bizarre and so crazy, and we didn't have contacts to get it. Managed, directors, stars, and studios we'd have to go too cold. We had no... Dan's only background was a low-budget Roger Corman movie. It made tiny money, and mine was none. So we didn't go anywhere. So Dan made the suggestion. I said, I know. Let's give it to Roger Corman. You know, the famous guy who discovered Cameron, Ron Howard, Jonathan Demme, all when they were nobodies. Let's give it to him and try and make this for a low budget, because he did this one low budget. It didn't do very well, but he financed it for me. And he might, we can do this for a low budget. I said, yeah, we can do it for a low budget. And still, we said it would still be a classic, even if done a low budget, like Night of the Living Dead, when it broke through. We thought it would be a little minor gem of a masterpiece. Dan gave it to Roger Corman. And to his credit, this is how brilliant the guy is at smelling talent. When you're nobody, and he just does it on a whim. Oh, this is going to be great. So 2 weeks later, he calls. He says, how much money do you want to make this? I said, we figured out we can do it for $1 million. He says, done. Let's make up the papers. You're kidding. No, I'm going to give you it right now. I smell this. This is going to be huge. A huge little film done for a small amount of money, but it's going to be a real breakthrough. We were all set to sign contracts with him and was so grateful. And again, we thought this can be done little, but it'll be a huge breakthrough. It'll make us, and Total Recall will be do it the big thing it requires. So we're ready to sign contracts in about a week. We were walking up the street, and this guy named Mark Haggard, who went to film school with Dan, sees us. Now, we had given the script to several of his film school guys I knew vaguely, you know, to give me opinion. And how good was it? Everyone said, oh, it's fantastic, fantastic script. So people knew about this script that Dan and I had ready to go, but didn't know how to go to the next step. So Mark Haggard's walking up the street, hadn't seen Dan since film school. He says, Dan, he says, well, let's get out of here. This guy's always saying he's got money, and he never has, and he doesn't have that much talent, but he's a hustler, and he's always telling me he's got financing for me. So let's avoid him. So we ran to an alley to get away from him. Dan, run. Oh, we said, okay, we got to talk to him. Listen, I heard you got this script, this fantastic script that all our contemporaries have been reading, Alien. I heard it's fantastic. We said, well, yeah, thanks. He said, can I read it? We said, well, we think we got the money to do it. Well, Roger Corman. I think I can do, from what I've heard of the script, somebody at the studio, I can't tell you what I have assigned to you, wants to do exactly this kind of movie that you're doing. For a medium budget horror, for the studio would be bigger than Roger Corman, but not as big as huge budget, but they want the dark side of Star Wars, since they had done Star Wars. And he said, they want to do a movie like this, like It, the Creature from Beyond Space, or The Green Slime. And everybody says, that's what you got. And he said, well, yeah, we got it, but we think we're going to do it now with Roger Corman already. He said, okay, I'll tell you what, give me one day. So we can do it. Okay, you let me read the script. And then if I tell you that I can get the money and a big league financing for it. I said, well, we can't give you much more. One day, yeah. Otherwise, we don't want to jeopardize our deal with Corman. She says, okay. And he calls us back, says, okay, I think I have a studio. I don't tell you what, because I'm not in the deal. I'm going to finance the whole thing for you. What's my deal with you? So we worked out the deal. Okay, you get 2% of the profits. You get associate producer. You get a $15,000 fee, because we didn't know what the budget would be, but he had no background he was trying to be. So we worked this piece of paper out. And he says, okay, leave blank and such will finance the movie. Leave it blank and sign everything but that, and then I'll fill the blank who's going to finance it. I said, oh, well, that's fair. Okay. And, you know, if they don't want to do it in a week, we got to forget about it and go with Corman. So we draw this paper up, and he puts the name, the 20th Century Fox. And I said, well, we've already halfway through with the script. We gave it to them, and they said, no, it's crazy. You know, which most, with no package and us, no background. And he said, well, that doesn't matter. I got the contact with Alan Ladd Jr., who's head. And you didn't go to the head? No. Okay, well, I think I can get to Alan Ladd Jr., which he did and got the movie made, but we didn't know it then. And he said, well, okay. Okay, you'll hear from me, and you'll know in a few days if they're going to give you the money. If not, you do it with Roger Corman. What happened is Alan Ladd Jr. said yes.
Well, how about, where did Gordon Carroll and David Giler and Walter Hill come in?
Okay, they were a partnership, three guys, Gordon Carroll, who produced Cool Hand Luke, is an old pro, a great old-time producer, but not hot, but hadn't had a hit since Cool Hand Luke, but a lot of experience. Walter Hill, who became pretty hot director after that, with movies he did, no real breakthroughs, but these action, gritty movies, and David Giler, who was very good at witty dialogue. They were all partners, and they had a deal at Fox, but no project, just Fox wanted to work with him, and they had a development deal. And so Haggard said, yeah, Brandywine is looking for this, and they've read 100 scripts, and they can't find one they like. They like this one, they'll make a partnership deal with you, and they'll get Fox to finance it, maybe, probably, because Fox wanted to work with him. So we said, okay. So we worked out this deal, a partnership, and they honored what Haggard would get from us, the agreement we had.
Didn't Giler and Hill do a big rewrite on the script?
Oh, yeah.
Into the office and saw a copy of Alien on the desk, and your name, and Dan's name wasn't on the script?
Right. Well, it's sort of natural. They were name writers. They were hot. They had a deal. That's the type of thing that usually happens, especially where nobody, and the studio's not sure if what you got is good. They think, but they're not sure. They were trying to change it, and it was half as good because they kept changing it and making it worse for over a period of weeks that they worked on it. So we had, you know, we were lucky to get maybe a chance to make it right later. We would maybe get it back on the track. So we said, yeah, okay. We didn't see their rewrites yet, but later they were working on it. But there was no director involved. The big thing is, if you don't have a director, you don't have a star, you don't really know if they're ever going to make it.
Was the movie greenlit before Ridley or after?
It was in the development, but not greenlit. They needed to get a director. They couldn't get a star, so they said, at least we got to get a director. And every director, what's his name, Robert Aldridge, the one that did Davy Jane with A Rat on the Plate and Dirty Dozen, he's known for gritty movies, not Altman, but Aldridge. They gave it to him, and we thought, sure, he'd like it. So everyone they went to, big, small, they all said, I don't want to do this goddamn Japanese horror thing with a thing coming out of guy's chest. Every big director said, every director fan said, I don't want to do this. And the stars said the same. They went, no, who wants to do this movie? This is going to get us laughed at. Then what happened was Ridley Scott enters the picture. He was in London. He didn't live in L.A. He did commercials. You know his early career. He was one of the biggest. He made that science fiction classic 1984 commercial. It was just a commercial.
Oh, he did. I didn't know that.
And that's what made him big in commercials. Ah. But he never done a movie. And the one movie he did flopped before Alien. One movie and it flopped. So it wasn't science fiction. But Fox thought he could become a terrific director, and they couldn't get another director. Because they tried, you know, when it went to a couple of directors, all said no. Stars, he said no. And then this guy, Ridley Scott, reads it in London and says, look, I love this thing. Well, come to America. Let's have a meeting. I want to direct it. So he comes in and meets with Dan and I and the other two writers that were working on it, Walter Hill and Giler. And so none of us know him from Adam, right? So that was our first meeting with Ridley Scott. So he comes in the meeting. I thought it was an odd choice because his one movie was a Renaissance France, I don't know, 1800 sword fighting movie, and it was terrible, right? And his other things were only 60 seconds long. So I got to admit that it was a great choice they made. I thought they were crazy. I thought, this guy, why? You know, we can't get anybody, but this guy doesn't seem like a good shot to be able to make this big science fiction movie. So that's the background of our first meeting, which lasts about an hour.
And didn't he say something like, I'm going to do the Texas Chainsaw Massacre of science fiction movies? That was his idea?
He wanted us to look at every low budget horror movie with him so he could get down how the scares happen, the choreographies. Give me every low budget science fiction that has jump, boo, boo, because I can't do that. And you guys know all these kind of movies. I'll watch them with you, and that'll make it so I understand how to choreograph the scares. That was just for that, not for the type of movie. But he did say something that made a huge breakthrough for me in that meeting. But he comes in. I thought, imagine, I think he's the wrong director. I think he's not even that good. He commercials, but he does this French farce. I don't know. And he starts talking to us, and then says, I'll tell you what, he's largely leaning towards a draft I hate because he hasn't read our draft. He's read Giler and Hill's draft, which I hated, but that can change, as it did. Sometimes you go back to the other draft. So he says, you know what I see in this? I want to make this the most edgier seat, white knuckle, frightening movie, but you got to give me the money to do it so it'll look like Kubrick, 2001. And I said, oh my God, he's the right director. This is what it'd be. And I knew he could make it look like because of visual stuff, but he said, I want to do it like all the most gripping, non-pretentious, low-budget horror, but look like Star Wars. Yeah, not Star Wars, 2001. I said, Jesus, this guy is the right director. Was I wrong? And so, but then he still wanted to do, had nothing, didn't even read our version because they gave him the version was rewritten. So he starts telling me, okay, I read your version. I guess he read ours originally, and then he read it later. So I start telling him why their version is terrible in a tactful way. I said, well, the only way it's going to work, you go back to when you first read it, you loved it, yeah. And then you read all these other drafts. I'm telling you why, and they're in the room with us. I say, of course, it's only natural. I'm prejudiced. I think their draft doesn't work, and ours does. But here's the reasons I think it. So I'm talking to her about an hour and a half. At the end of an hour and a half, he says, you're right. Yes, you're right. The rewrites don't work. The first draft, for all the reasons you said, I just got confused.
So, Ron, what was it about the Giler Hill draft that didn't work?
Okay, in general, they just didn't work at all. Because when you try to make something, not just finesse it a little, but when you change it into something else. So they changed it between, one guy did one draft, another guy, Giler did one draft, Hill's help, Hill did one with him. Hill traded into a gritty action like he had instead of the spaceships or he had lockers, World War II lockers, something. No, it's not that. It's a science fiction movie. He wanted to make it realistic and contemporary, but still the science fiction creatures.
But not in space? He didn't want it in space?
No, I think he didn't even want it in space. I think he wanted it on Earth and make it like a bunker war of the future or something. And Giler wanted it, it was a little too cutesy. He was trying to do it. He wrote Dick and Jane with Jane Fonda.
Fun with Dick and Jane?
Yeah. So he had that comedic feeling to it. They were good, complimented each other. So he wanted to do it more like that. Hill wanted to do it like a gritty thing, but not science fiction enough. And Giler missed it too. So between them, they didn't have any draft that came close to working. I was sure if our draft, a lot of people started thinking it was really good. I'm sure that I couldn't be that wrong. Maybe they, if they hadn't gone so totally into different movies, I would have thought maybe I'm wrong. I articulated this to Ridley, and I can be very persuasive, as everybody knows. But they have the reputation, and Dan and I have never even sold a script, but the one that Roger Corman did for him is low budget from film school. Otherwise, neither of us sold a script, let alone made a movie. So why should, and these guys, Hill had done, directed one low budget, the action that worked, Giler, they had background, they had the deal, and we were outgunned, you know, it seemed like, but I became so persuasive in that meeting, as I told them all the reasons why we were there, but I tried to be tactful. So here's why I think it's way off the track. Well, we did work. Here's what I think. So I went on talking for about an hour. At the end of an hour, he looks at me, he says, he's right, isn't he? And he said, no, he says, he's right. He said, the other writer says, no, he's wrong. He said, well, I don't think so. I'm the director. You want me? You got to be the director. I want to move it. I want to go back to the other draft. And, well, and so they said, okay, we got to get this guy out. That's what Giler and Hill are saying to each other, whispering. We got to go down and get him out. So we all come out of the meeting, and I see Alan Ladd, who's head of the studio, and the one that said, I think this can work, and wanted to develop it. He's coming out of his office, and Giler and Hill run over. He says, Ron Shusett has seized control of the film. He says he knows nothing. He's a damn... And suddenly Ridley Scott thinks every word he says is the Bible. He says he's an amateur. What's happening here? And so they don't know. I'm in the bathroom, and I'm hearing this because I just walked to the men's room, and I can hear what they're saying. And so Maddie says to him, well, listen, guys, this is the way it works. He doesn't know Ridley Scott. You don't know Ridley Scott. He has less chance than you of getting to do what he wants. So you try and work on Ridley. He's already worked on him. Whoever gets the director that we want to go with this guy, that's the version we got to go with. If it's Ron's version, it's Ron's version. We know the director determines that. And so I'm in the men's room, and I'm laughing because, oh, my God, I won. And there's nothing they can do about it. Because he said, they keep interfering. I want to do your shot. They don't want me to shoot your version. So by accident, I got control because Ridley and I were on the same page. Our deal was we would be allowed to be during the filming. Dan and I both. Dan not as a producer, as a consultant on special effects. Me as executive producer, and both of us as writers. So from then on, anything I said, Ridley wanted.
Was that you know, Ridley believing your script, was that a vindication?
It was all the difference in the world.
You and Dan as screenwriters.
Oh, absolutely. They were successful screenwriters. We were nobody, totally untried. But what happened, it got even intensified when we got to pre-production.
So that puts a nice bow at the end of Ron's story of the early days of the making of Alien. Tune into next episode of An Alien in Hollywood, where we get into principal photography and pre-production with fantastic stories of working with Ridley Scott and early days with the cast, including Sigourney Weaver, who were a group of relative unknowns at the time. So this was fantastic to record, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it just as much as I did. If you haven't done so already, subscribe to An Alien in Hollywood anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts.